The buck starts here.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the morning open. A look at the economy as we're just minutes into the trading day. Earnings out, but the dollar gets in the way. Plenty of the newly jobless seeking dollars from Uncle Sam. First, where's Wall Street? S&P 500 up about a quarter of a percent, a third of a percent for the NASDAQ, and the Dow's up as well about a third of a percent at 89.07. European markets mostly flat right now. Asian shares closed higher today as well. Jane DeRista is with the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She joins us live this morning on the phone. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Lots of earnings out today. We could be here till Labor Day talking about them, but we have McDonald's and Philip Morris saying profits are down thanks to a stronger dollar. I thought a stronger dollar is good for the economy, Jane.
No, it is not. It never has been. It's good for the financial sector, and that certainly translates into good things for Goldman Sachs. But if companies have lots of overseas operations, their earnings are going to be down because they're getting paid in weaker currencies over there and translating into the stronger dollar. Also, their exports are going to be down because you can't sell abroad and you can't sell at home if there's a strong dollar.
We also heard from AT&T this morning as well. Their profits slid 15% thanks to all the hoopla over the iPhone. But the iPhone is one of the most popular phones around. I mean, why isn't AT&T in better shape?
There's an awful lot of competition coming out there from the Internet, from the cable companies, from Skype, et cetera. And, of course, also the point is that AT&T was selling those phones with a lot of discount.
All right, Jane, hang on the line just for a moment. We got word this morning that the initial unemployment claims rose a bit last week, more than 500,000 people filing claims for the first time. We're going to check in live with our New York Bureau and Marketplace's Amy Scott, who's got the latest on that. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So what do these numbers tell us?
Well, we've got sort of a mix of good and bad news in these figures. Overall, first-time jobless claims have been falling since the spring, and the number of people continuing to receive unemployment insurance fell last week. But I'm told that's partly because more people are exhausting their benefits. So the jobs picture is still pretty bleak.
So we've been hearing a lot lately about this idea of a jobless recovery, Amy. Looks like these numbers bolster that notion.
Well, in the last few recessions in this country, jobs have taken a long time to recover to their previous levels. Some say it could be 5 or 6 years this time around. Employers are reluctant to start hiring until they see a sustained recovery. I talked to economist Hugh Johnson with Johnson Illington Advisors, and he says unemployment is likely to stay high even as other parts of the economy improve, and that could actually threaten the recovery.
You can have a recovery without much job growth, but you don't get a solid recovery unless you get solid job growth and consumer spending. Ordinarily, you have to have both.
So people might fairly ask, what good is a recovery if you don't have jobs? And Johnson says it's just going to take a little bit more patience this time around.
All right. Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us from New York. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
We do appreciate it. All right, Jane DeRista, is that on target, a recovery perhaps, but one without jobs?
Well, I think that the point is being well made that unless you have the wage income, things are not going to turn around in this economy. People have to pay down debt. We're still going to have a housing problem, which we have not solved. We have a commercial real estate problem because people are not going to malls and buying things. So all of these little bits and pieces add up over the place. And it's also a problem in terms of the loss of jobs for spending. What is happening to people's savings, what is happening to their 401ks, et cetera.
All right. Jane DeRista joining us from Massachusetts this morning. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We're going to get earnings from Amazon later today. It announced that it's buying shoe megasite Zappos.com at an $850 million deal. Amazon and other retail websites, of course, rely on the power of the almighty buck. Yet some states have been trying to force those so-called e-tailers to collect sales taxes. And lawmakers are targeting in-state companies that partner with those retailers. From Station KUOW in Seattle, Deborah Wong reports.
HungryGirl.com is a pretty typical example of the kind of company that's now in the spotlight. It's a California-based website that's all about cooking. Its homepage features a colorful, low-calorie cookbook.
So if I were to click on the button that says buy it now, it would take me to the Amazon page, and then I can just complete the purchase right from here.
Patty Smith is a spokeswoman for Amazon. She says Amazon pays Hungry Girl a small commission every time a visitor clicks through and buys a copy of the book, about 4% of the purchase price.
Which, for the referring website, is free money.
HungryGirl.com is what's called an affiliate. Amazon and a host of other retailers have affiliate networks all over the world. They argue affiliates act sort of like advertisers, but some states are challenging that. They say affiliates are like remote sales offices, which means the retailer has a physical presence in the state and would be required to collect state sales tax. State Senator David Hoyle is from North Carolina.
They need to pay us, and it is something that I think is wrong, and we want it fixed.
Last year, New York became the first state to pass a law to that effect, and this year, a host of other states, including North Carolina, Rhode Island, and California, have considered various versions of what's been called the Amazon tax. But it hasn't worked out the way it was intended for states. Jeffrey Lindsay is a senior analyst for the Internet at Sanford Bernstein.
So in a sense, it kind of backfired.
Amazon and other retailers like Overstock.com have fought back. They've responded by severing their relationships with affiliates in several states, including Rhode Island and North Carolina. So if there are no sales, there's no revenue for the states. That has caused some states to rethink the Amazon tax. The governor of Hawaii recently vetoed a sales tax measure, and the governor of California vowed to veto one as well.
Bearing in mind that particularly California has backed down, it'll discourage other states from trying to apply the same rules.
But the fight is by no means over. North Carolina is still debating a version of the tax, and lawmakers in California plan to introduce it again. In Seattle, I'm Deborah Wong for Marketplace.
Hey, check us out online at our website, marketplace.org. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Have a great day.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.